And very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
You might hear a little bit of wind. That's because we're on top of Mount Rainier. Well, actually, that's not true. We're not really on top of Mount Rainier. If I get technical about it, we're only about a third of the way up. But it's as far as we can get before the authorities step in and turn us back. Yeah, and we tried. We tried to go further, but we can't.
Yeah, and you really would want a little bit more equipment. We just brought sort of t-shirts and tennis shoes, but this situation would you would want maybe some snowshoes or some cross country skis and some alpine equipment.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you would if you wanted to make it to the top. But you know, this is good enough. We're standing actually at the visitor center, and we had to go a ways away from that to get away from all the screaming kids and cars going back and forth. It's really pathetic. the mountain itself is amazing, and if we could only get into the part that there were no people in, it would be so much better. But, you know, we were looking at this thing from Seattle, and I was just, you know, curious. I said, Kyle, what's that? And you told me it's Mount Rainier. And I said, why don't we go there? Because it's not going to come to us, so we have to go to it, and that's what we did. It's a lot further away than it looks. It took about 2 hours to get here, but we did. And there's snow on the ground where we are now. I'd say, I'm not kidding, there's easily 20 feet, 15 feet piled up, walls of snow alongside the roads and in the forest. I don't know if it's 20 feet of snow in the forest, but when you're driving, there's about maybe 15 feet above the ground.
Yes, and once you get to this part of the park, it's certainly stacked up even higher, 25 and up. But what is interesting and notable, noteworthy from our perspective on the way up, we saw a lot of runoff, and you see it here melting, and that's an indication of springtime and
yes.
The change in season. A lot of people have been photographing waterfalls and various parts of the trip where you can see life changing in really interesting ways.
Is it legal to photograph waterfalls? I wasn't sure about that.
I didn't see a sign that indicated you couldn't photograph waterfalls, but in any event, there are plenty of people indulging and slowing down a little, taking time to stop and take things in.
Yeah, definitely. It's we're about how many thousand feet up would you say we are?
The elevation here is about 5,400 feet.
I'm feeling it. You know, it's hard to breathe and walk up a hill and do various other things, but I guess as you go even further up, it'd be even worse.
Yeah, the height. It's a lower oxygen than you're used to if you live at sea level, but it definitely makes you feel a little loopy if you start marching around too much your heart rate increases.
Well, it's just, I find myself taking shallower breaths, and, I'd rather not do that. I'd rather breathe nice full breaths. But as we go back down, I'm sure my ears will pop more and we'll get back to normal breathing, which is often asked. But it's really amazing because, you know, there's snow all over the place here, not on the road. The road is completely clear, but the snow is here. It's not really melting so much. I mean, there's dripping, there's waterfalls, as Kyle mentioned. But it's here. It seems to be here for the duration. The snow stays pretty much year-round, doesn't it?
That's right. It slowly melts. At least that's the hope. And so you want to basically have a significant snowfall at the lowest possible elevation throughout winter, so that this snowpack builds up, and then around this time of year, it begins to slowly melt at various elevations, probably starting in the lower elevations first and working its way up. And by the end of the summer, this mountain is a lot more gray, a lot more brown.
Uh-huh.
It still keeps some snowpack near the top in normal years, as far as I know, just anecdotally. It's a fun thing to watch. You see the mountain from different perspectives in the Puget Sound. It looks larger in some ways, and people joke that it's moved around on wheels. because it depends, like, where you are in the lowlands or on a hill or from a certain vantage, it can look a really different way. And it's sort of something that everybody looks at. It's an active volcano. And
yeah, you mentioned that on the way up here. In fact, you pointed out volcano sirens in a neighboring town. And you said this is an active volcano. Well, okay, first of all, where's the hole for the volcano? It's up on the top? Obviously, it would be up on the top. But you're saying there is a volcano there that could spew forth at any moment.
Well, yeah, there's a significant amount of earth and snow on top of it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, this is active in that it has erupted and would continue to be able to erupt given the right conditions geologically. So yeah, this is part of the Cascade Mountain Range, and there's an additional range further to the west coast along the Pacific called the Olympic Mountain Range. It's really kind of a fascinating ability. Really not that far from the urban interface in the Puget Sound, you can sort of escape and really change totally, being like basically a portal to this other kind of world. And it's a testament to our national parks. It's a federal national park that they maintain, and various people do climb and do other activities out here. You can go back here. They have like a hill for tubing, and there's just all kinds of activity here.
Not very much right now, except a bunch of kids running around a parking lot and sliding down snow and screaming, which you can't hear because we walked away from that a little bit. But it's as I said, it's interesting because the snow is here, but it's not cold. You could walk around. Kyle's wearing a T-shirt. You don't know if it's supposed to be spring or winter right now. So I'm a little confused by that. I don't know what happens at night. If we got stuck in here, in fact, we have to be out of here pretty soon. They locked the gate for some reason. If you're here at night, I don't know if you'd freeze to death or just get bored to death by having absolutely nothing around except for the mountain and the snow. It is something that I'm glad we did. I'm glad we came up here. I've always been curious about this, about what it's like to just actually drive over to Rainier. I'm sure there are all kinds of other things to see in the area as well that are just as different.
Yeah, it's a really neat drive, and something I wanted to share with you. And it just occurred to us to take a drive up here and experience all along the way too. It's part of things being a journey. There's so much community and various small towns that you go through, and all different sort of agrarian and other lifestyles occurring, and you realize that is what contributes to a lot of what you see in the cities here in the Northwest.
Yes. Now we should probably get moving before I pass out.
I feel okay.
Well, I'm happy for you. But yeah, I'm fine. I mean, I'm not gonna.
The sun is really bright.
The sun is really bright. You can't really see if you're taking a picture or something.
We're a lot closer to the atmosphere. We're getting more gamma rays. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. A lot of radiation.
That's not good, right? That's bad.
Yeah, that's, you know, you want to minimize that.
Uh-huh.
I'm ready to go.
Okay, I'm ready to go too. Dude, why'd you park so far away?
You've got to be kidding me.
Everything is uphill. I know it's a mountain. Mountains go two ways. What a mountain is. Well, we're off the mountain now, and we're at a, I think it's a train station. It was a train station once. It's a building. Looks a lot like a train station you'd see on the LIRR, but there's nobody here, and it hasn't been used in years, apparently.
Yeah, I think they use it as a maintenance depot or a small office to whatever kind of crews service the tracks here.
Yeah, the tracks being, well, what runs on these tracks, Kyle?
Well, there's some commuter trains as well as freight trains that occasionally come through here. And
basically to the west of the tracks is downtown Kent, and so there's a lot of different crossings and places where traffic is coming and going from town.
Okay. Now, it's interesting because you have a lot of different types of things that come down these tracks. You've got Amtrak, you've got basically, there's the Amtrak train we rode on, which was called the, what was that called again?
The
Coastal...
Coast Starlight.
Starlight.
I don't want to get it confused with the Cascade.
No, because that's the other kind.
Yeah.
The Cascade is more of a regional Amtrak train. It goes from Seattle to, I think, Portland, maybe some other parts of Oregon. A
couple other routes, north-south, yeah.
And then you also have what's known as the Sounder, which is...
elusive.
Yeah, it's a commuter line here in Seattle, but it's really weird because it doesn't run apart from certain times. It's very few trains. It only runs basically in the morning going to Seattle and then in the afternoon coming from Seattle. But if you want to get to Seattle in the afternoon or in the evening, you're out of luck. It's just very, very few trains. I don't understand the logic behind it. I think it's because they have to share the track with the freight lines or something silly like that. And then, of course, on this rail line, you have the freight lines. And that's really cool, because a train with, like, 100 cars will come barreling through every now and then.
Yeah, yeah. So it's heavily, heavily trafficked with large trains. And these trains typically have things like, they have lumber or occasionally coal, sometimes oil tanker cars that carry various fluids, flammable and otherwise. As well as lumber and automobiles. There's a lot of car carriers that come through here, but it's mostly freight. And really, there is more interest in running the Sounder as a more frequent local regional train. But it has yet to come to fruition as far as midday service and stuff, but maybe in 2017 they're going to add that. There's also a major Sound Transit proposal. There have been one or two that have gotten us this far with the Sounder and the Link Light Rail stations all over, including the extensions at SeaTac Airport, as well as the ones up on Broadway and at the UW. This next one is going to be voted on in November, and it's called ST3, or Sound Transit 3, and there's a lot of sort of going through that next proposal and discussion about what comprehensive really means here, and what are the needs, and so forth.
Well, I just stuck my head out to see if a freight train was coming, and when I did that, I caught the eye of a cop crossing the tracks in his black and white vehicle, so I might look very suspicious, and we might have a visitor soon, because we're standing at an abandoned train station. Basically just peering our heads out to see what's coming.
Right.
Which, to me, isn't suspicious at all, but to other people might seem that way.
Well, I guess if you just have a telephone, or if you put a gesture in, like, a very logical way, like you're being very concise and making a point, I think there's a lot less of a chance of anyone really being all that interested in you. And, I mean, it's not as though we're doing anything untoward. Really, we're just watching trains and leaning up against this building. So I don't know. I mean, I have a cell phone, but I don't actually feel a pressure or any kind of need to withdraw it from my pocket.
Well, yeah. I mean, we are standing by an abandoned train station. We'd like to know more about it. The Kent station that no one uses anymore.
Yeah, it was Titusville?
Titusville used to be the name of this town. We learned that. And it's also about a block or so away from the current Sounder station, which is in use when there are Sounder trains.
Yeah, they did not destroy this. And I think it's good that they didn't. They kept the sort of historic Kent Station building, and as we said, is an office or sort of an annex for maintenance and rail crew. But the actual station is about a block up, and it is connected to a very large parking garage, which is important because a lot of people, if they're going to take a bus or take a short trip to get to the station, they're going to obviously need accommodations, and here a lot of that means cars. So I guess that may have been one of the considerations, is that they'll have more space for the parking garage down there, and they'll build new platforms, and so that is what they did.
One of the things that I find fascinating about this area, and I like to see differences. I like to see, when I go to a part of the country, something that really stands out and is completely different than what I'm used to. And one of the things here is the fact that you have so many freight trains all over the place. And not only do you have freight trains, you have at least two different freight train companies. This is, what's this one called? This is the B something?
BNSF, Burlington Northern Santa Fe is one.
Okay, and then you have Union Pacific, which is really pretty close. Look, a few blocks over, there's another train crossing, and that's Union Pacific Freight. And not only do you have these crossings, you have trains that go through all the time. And in fact, here's one coming now. If you go to Seattle, you'll see trains crawling all throughout the place, some of them going very slowly down little streets. And it just makes me wonder, what is it that they're doing differently, that they're making deliveries or picking up cargo inside the city that does not happen back in New York, and certainly not on Long Island. I just find that fascinating to watch, just to see all the different networks of systems that are in play here and how they all coordinate each other. I mean, somebody is saying, yeah, you got to drive this engine down this particular rail at this particular speed and do this. And I'm fascinated by where is that control coming from. And it's a nationwide system, because people are sending things, massive amounts of things, cargo containers from other cities, and they're making their way across the country, and it's all making sense somehow.
Yeah, it actually has quite a bit of organization and design behind it. In many ways, there is a similar process with vessels and ocean-going ships. Large orders like that tend to take a long time. So what you have is delivery dates and pickup dates of empty rail equipment that span months. Very similar to what it's like when you might receive something from overseas. So you might have, unless your business has a requirement for trains day in, day out, you're in some sort of materials handling like petroleum or cement, concrete, you need dry materials and so on very frequently, or lumber distribution, maybe that's an everyday thing. But even on those small streets, there might be just a mile or two of siding, and maybe only two or three businesses really even use the rail anymore there, and they might get deliveries once a month, or a tanker car will be parked and it'll take a month or two to fill up or empty. So the scheduling and the timing is a little slower, especially on those like arterials and little side streets where you've noticed some of those deliveries occurring.
By the way, we're standing right next to a crossing, so any second now, the crossing gate's going to go down. You're going to hear the bells. That's another thing that's different here. The bells continue after the gate's down. Here it goes now, in fact. Yep. The gates are going down. The cars are backing up, the ones that have gone too far.
This is sort of a slow-moving train.
It's a slow-moving train.
It's taking a while.
I looked down. It was parked, but I think it's picking up speed now, and boy, is he leaning on that horn. Let's see what we got. BNSF locomotive on our track. What kind of cars are these? Coal.
They might be empty. I don't know. I can't see the top.
There's only two locomotives. It's a lot of cars, though. I've seen as many as four or five locomotives on some trains.
Pretty dusty.
Pretty dusty.
A lot of black soot.
Sometimes they stick a locomotive in the back, too.
Yeah, Yeah, that's all cold.
I'm looking back, and there's no end in sight to the strength.
Now, as I was saying, sometimes they mix orders, and these will be, you know, a couple cars of coal, a couple of this, a couple of that. This is definitely all for one material, a dry, top-loaded material.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I'd be sitting at a crossing waiting for all this. We're not used to that back home. I still don't see the end of the string. It's incredible. Must be well over 100 cars.
Hey, look at the railroad ties, the way they're flexing in the ground.
Should we be nervous with that?
Yeah, it's just a lot of weight.
Okay, I think I might see the end of the train in the distance. I think I see a locomotive at the end. Epic.
That was a very, very intense experience.
Wow. I mean, that train wasn't going particularly fast. It was going good, 40, 45 miles an hour, but I've seen it go faster. But wow, was that long. And of course, everyone was just waiting patiently at the crossings.
And life goes right back to normal.
Right back to normal. We bitch and moan when a LIRR train goes by, which is like 8 cars. But this, and this happens a lot, you know, trains like that go by pretty frequently in all different areas.
Yeah, it's not taken for granted, but the signaling and bells, people know what that's about, and I guess it's just normalized in a lot of ways. I will say, though, they need to do a little track maintenance down here. They could use some concrete ties and at least give some of those nails in the railroad ties an extra whack with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, it's something, because freight is a priority, and when freight's a priority, you see expansion, you see rails being built all over the place. And if we had that same kind of priority system in place for passenger service, we'd see high-speed rail in this country, not overnight, but really quickly, and we'd see expansions of all sorts. So it's possible to do these things if you believe it's important. And out here, freight is extremely important, so you see it everywhere.
And it's really a simple system. It's nothing fancy here. I mean, this has been going on for centuries.
Centuries? I guess, 1800s.
At least one or two.
Yeah. The LIRR goes back to the 1800s, and it still looks like it belongs there.
I mean, this is century-old technology. I guess that's fair enough to say.
Yeah.
And to say nothing of high speed, as you've indicated.
Well, like I said, I can see things that are different. And in this particular part of the world, there are lots of things that are different if you take the time and see. Like just the things that you find in shopping centers or on the streets. You'll see all these places that say teriyaki on them. And, you know, to me teriyaki is like a sauce. But here, it's like a food. It's like something that is a way to describe a particular type of food. And you just see it like we would see, I don't know, what's like pizza or something in a shopping center. Every shopping center has a place called teriyaki. And how would you describe it, Kyle?
It's basically various ways of preparing chicken breasts or different cuts of meat. Sometimes they're breaded. Sometimes it's like all teriyaki or more like spicy, like with a chili sauce as well as a teriyaki flavor. But it's, sort of a, I don't know, it's sort of ubiquitous, but I think, as you pointed out, goes really unnoticed, and it doesn't really have a specific parallel or facsimile elsewhere. It's basically, I guess, Japanese is, teriyaki is Japanese, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a type of a sauce that's known in Japan, but the places that we go to, in fact, I saw an article about this in the New York Times, of all places, they say that you can get teriyaki in Somali places, in Korean places, Chinese, all different nationalities get behind this somehow. And it's turned into a real big thing here in Seattle, or in the Pacific Northwest.
I didn't even really see it the way you were seeing it. It was sort of in the periphery to me. I mean, I'm aware and, like, had an idea of, like, my favorite place I would go to get teriyaki, which I took you to.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't see it quite as a phenomena as you were seeing it. Like, I talk about bikini baristas and the whole...
We'll get to that.
Coffee shack culture, which originated here and, you know, from a lot of the 90s subculture that was going on with coffee and so stuff. But this was this whole other phenomena that was right under my nose. But when you pointed it out, it is true. It's sort of any kind of proprietor could proclaim a teriyaki place. And they could sell other food there, too. They could sell, like, burgers and teriyaki
right.
and just still call it a teriyaki place. But it's sort of a harsh way to put it would be, like, a generic restaurant. It's not that, though, but there's no, like, hard rule or standard. So you could say you're a teriyaki place and just sell, like, burgers with chicken cutlet and, like, some teriyaki sauce, and that would be as close as you wouldn't even need rice. But a lot of the places have, like, rice as a side and a salad and are, like, integrate other parts of food culture, like chopsticks and stuff that's got actual sort of indigenous and historical placement. So it's kind of like an amalgamation mm-hmm. of different things, but you can't say as a rule you'll be able to go into any teriyaki place and be able to find chopsticks. It might not be a thing.
That's right. They didn't
place.
Have chopsticks.
Yeah.
That was interesting. It's not like you couldn't find this food in New York. You could, but this wouldn't be advertised as a teriyaki place.
Across the board, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be able to get food with teriyaki on it, obviously, and that particular style in different areas.
They might have their own fancy name or whatnot.
But what's weird is just seeing the word teriyaki in so many places, and I just thought that was... It's kind of equivalent to when you travel in the Midwest. You'll start seeing signs for Coney Islands. Like, what in the world is a Coney Island? Turns out a Coney Island is what they call a hot dog. We think of Coney Island, you know, in Brooklyn, as the place where hot dogs are. It's a very popular food, but they've taken that a step further and just described the area as the hot dog. So that's, when you go out in the Midwest, you'll see all these Coney Island places, and that really threw me for a loop the first time I saw that. But the other thing here that I find really incredible, too, is the proliferation of Vietnamese food. That's something, as you know, I've been bemoaning the lack of that in Long Island for ages. But not only do you have a lot of Vietnamese places here, probably because you're on the Pacific Ocean, or near the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, the Pacific Rim, as we call it, it's directly across from Asia, and up and down this coast are a lot of immigrants and people who have made their lives here.
But you also have the Vietnamese soup being advertised. It's known as pho, spelled P-H-O. A lot of people say pho, it's wrong, don't say it that way. And you just see it everywhere, P-H-O. As common as teriyaki places.
Yeah.
And that's something that's very different. I mean, we do have Vietnamese places in New York, in New York City mostly, but they're Vietnamese places. They don't say pho everywhere like they do here. And that has just become sort of a recognizable word.
But
and it's great to see people that aren't Vietnamese going there and pronouncing it right, and it's just a part of their lives. So that is something that is really very, very different about this part.
Yeah, that is a... part of the real, like, multicultural magic of the Pacific Northwest that, like, a farmer or somebody who kind of grew up in the country out here would feel as nostalgic and have as much an opinion about their favorite pho spot as like, a burger joint or anywhere else. So I would say, too, that any place that does say pho is as about authentic to Vietnamese as you will find. I mean, you're not going to go wrong. If they're indicating that, they're definitely a Vietnamese establishment selling pretty high-quality soup and banh mi and so on.
Okay, well, you just said another word there, which we can get into. But pho, okay, let's just describe it quickly for people that might not be familiar, because it will become popular someday on Long Island and various other parts of the country. Pronounced P-H-U-H, not P-H-O like it's spelled. It's a big bowl of soup.
It's a marrow broth, so it's cooked for at least 8 to 10 hours, if not longer.
They made a point of telling us that yesterday. They said it takes 10 hours. Takes 2 minutes to serve, but 10 hours to make, or something like that. So we didn't have any preconceived notions.
And we didn't prompt her. She said that as though we would, you know, want an indication that that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they have a broth and serve it with a variety of different kinds of meats. I think tripe is one of them. It's, a body part, like lung or something.
You get meatballs. You can get a mixture of all different things. There's vegetable options of all sorts. And you get all kinds of attachments, too, that you can add into it.
Yeah, they serve... It's sort of a fusion of French cooking to a degree. So the garnishes, there's, like, fresh basil as a garnish, bean sprouts, and chilies, of course.
Yes.
You've got to have some peppers and the ubiquitous... plum and sriracha, like hot sauce.
Hot sauce and all sorts of things like that. And it's always massively big, too. For some reason, these soups are really, really served in large bowls.
And it warms you up.
It does.
It is really good on a rainy day, which used to be a big occurrence here in the Seattle area. But any day, really, is a good day for pho. And it's usually quite affordable as well.
That's true.
And it's kind of a great lunchtime thing to do, or to bring home.
Now, you've mentioned banh mi, which is another Vietnamese food, little sandwiches.
Yep.
That you can get them in New York City as well, but again, it's really hard to find on Long Island, and hopefully that will go away someday. We'll be able to find those easily. But how would you describe banh mi?
That's also got some elements of French cuisine, but mainly... The bread itself that sandwich is made on is a what you would call a demi baguette, like a half of a large baguette, and that's basically got a bit of like shredded carrot and some chilies if you're lucky, and a little bit of like cilantro and some other garnish, as well as either a pate of some kind, a tofu, like a brined tofu, something that's aged a bit and has a bit of a vinegar or some kind of flavoring or seasoning, or also like a pulled pork or other kind of meat that you could add to it. That's it, really. It's a very simple sandwich. Sometimes there's a little bit of a dressing, like a mayo or some kind of dressing, spice dressing. Really a fantastic, quick sandwich.
And also cheap.
Very, very affordable, and it's really, really not uncommon for people to say, like, oh, let's get some banh mi, or it's part of that whole pho culture where it would be just, like, understood exactly what someone's talking about if they said banh mi.
And it's interesting, too, it's on a baguette. That's due to the French influence of the country back in those days. It's interesting to see how it's evolved into something like this. And again, it's a really enjoyable part of being out here.
I was kind of late to it, growing up as a native kid here. I think I slowly realized what these things I did have some experience with growing up. I slowly realized what that all was, and definitely this has been very fun to look at it through a bit more of like our traveling lens. Because I don't feel like I'm taking it for granted as much. I'm definitely seeing it as one entire kind of subculture in sort of what is available cuisine-wise.
Well, when you came to New York for the first time, you must have seen some things like that there that were alien to you, that just were common to us. Does anything spring to mind?
Lots of things spring to mind. Definitely, like, any kind of extension, like, of... food carts, because obviously that's like a cliched sort of normal thing for New York, like hot dog carts and stuff, but all the fast food that springs up around that, like if you go from cart to then like countertop, pizza places for sure, very odd, places where you can get pizza and fried chicken or something, like weird combinations of stuff, that definitely is something I notice. Yeah, I don't know. Deli culture is absolutely one of them as well. The way you say you would like a submarine sandwich.
A what now?
A hero.
Okay.
In New York is entirely different here. Here you would ask for a sub or a submarine sandwich or maybe even a grinder. I don't know.
But boy, people are weird.
Yeah. Like, a hero out here is, like, Turkish food.
Okay. You know, and on that note, too, you took me to a Greek place, a quote-unquote Greek place.
Yes, I did.
Not going to name it, but they have, I mean, they do have grape leaves and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But they also have a dish known as chicken tikka, and that to me sounds like Indian. But maybe it could be Afghan or something like that. But they also have dishes that are Iraqi style.
Yes.
I mean, come on, it's not really Greek, and the name of the place isn't Greek either. And I just wonder, do you guys know what a Greek place is? I mean, I don't see very many of them around, if any, to be honest. I also don't see very many Indian places either, so maybe that's why the tikka thing got out without anybody catching that. It's also, you know, it's just an amalgamation of different cuisines, and I guess you can call it Greek in some parts of the country and call it something else in a different part, and it all sort of it has similarities.
Yeah, I think it's also sort of wanting to broaden their customer base. Like, there's, I think, this normalizing, like they want to be as approachable as possible, and so what someone might think of like kebab, that's that sort of meat and sandwich, also known as a gyro, or falafel and stuff, I think they can say like, yeah, this is sort of Greek, like in the area, like Mediterranean food, even though it's not the brunt of their menu, like a lot of the other stuff had, as you said, like Iraqi and more Indian flavoring and recipes behind them. There are Indian, I mean, there are neighborhoods with pockets of Indian food. We haven't really been to them, like we haven't looked into that as much. But there are, I think, less Indian places here. Less than there should be.
Yeah.
There's a really good place in Tacoma I like to go to. That's probably like the one I know of in Tacoma. And then there's a
city,
couple
though.
In Seattle. Yeah. Yeah. There's like a couple in Seattle up by Seattle Center and I think on Broadway and in Capitol Hill and some of those neighborhoods. But it's not as ubiquitous out in the suburbs, out in the south of the city. And definitely Greek places, I think, proper, like what you might say Mediterranean food, dolmas, and that like strictly Greek cuisine, I think is also a little bit too specific for around here. So there's not going to be like a whole Greek community that's going to be upset that this place that's a bit more like Turkish than Greek is using Greek in their name.
Well, at least Greece and Turkey are pretty close to each other geographically.
Yeah.
But when you start throwing in Indian cuisine and Iraqi cuisine and things like that, then you have to wonder, you know, are we just trying to soothe the blow a little bit so that we're not too scared of this ethnic food that's surrounding us?
Or maybe they put those recipes on the menu for their friends that come in that might say, wait a minute, why don't you have this? And, you know, it's just sort of slid in there. And then the rest of us just presume, yeah, oh, this must be Greek.
Well, all I know is I'm going to try the Iraqi-style dish, whatever that is, next time I go to that place, because I'm curious.
There's also a fair amount of, like, North African and, like, Ethiopian food and a really huge variety. You really have to look for it.
Cool. Well, okay, now speaking of variety and weird stuff, let's go back to something you mentioned a little while ago, bikini baristas. Okay. You can tell us about that in a second, but first I just want to explain, speaking of the things that are different here in the Seattle area, almost every shopping center, it seems, I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but so many of them have, how can I describe this so people in New York would know? Okay, maybe you remember little photomat houses that were in shopping centers where people would drive up and deposit this stuff that was known as film. And have it developed by them. You come back a few days later, and they give it to you. Or maybe a little drive-up ATM, little tiny buildings in parking lots of shopping centers. Well, out here, there are so many of those things that are espresso houses, I guess is the best way to describe them. Little coffee places. You don't go in, you drive up, and you get your coffee that way. Yeah, they got Starbucks here. Yeah, they started Starbucks here. But that's not as prevalent as you might think. These little coffee places are everywhere. I can't understand why we don't have a single one of them in New York. It couldn't cost very much to run something like that. You basically just need some water coming into it, and maybe a little bit of power, but that's it. So tell us something about the history of these places, and what in God's name is a bikini barista?
You might remember a time when Starbucks was not like fast food and everywhere. And I'm talking about the 90s. I'm talking about a time when what was going on is a huge dot-com boom. And what you had was a lot of what were known as barista carts. And these carts would be wheeled out in various places. And you would go to an espresso cart in front of maybe a department store or another location, and they were on wheels. So that was sort of the genesis of the shack. And those were real espresso machines on a cart that had a refrigerator in it for the milk and stuff, and they were sort of like pop-up stores, I guess, before pop-up stores existed. Anyway, this was sort of the fuel for the Java that was supporting the Java in the tech revolution that was going on at the time. And I think basically Starbucks filled that void a lot. And also we had a tech bust, the dot-com bubble, as it were. And so a couple different things were occurring at the same time, and partly it was the explosion of Starbucks as a retail outlet for coffee by the uniformity and just the flooding of that, as well as McDonald's. And what that actually gets into is the super automatic espresso machine. I'm not going to get into any of that, but I will say the original barista carts had real Italian, like, well-built espresso machines, and those baristas actually had to know how to pull a shot of espresso. What that has been replaced with was the Starbucks retail outlets and everything else that competes with that, be it Dunkin' or McDonald's or whatever. But those establishments don't actually have real espresso machines and, dare I say, real baristas, because they're all super automatic machines that you basically press a button and it drips out coffee at you from some pneumatic pump. So now, in this area, people commute a lot, and you have less of this sort of tech thing going on and more retail cafes, which are sort of fake and, as I said, watered down with machines. It's sort of sad. So a lot of the competition with these shacks is to get commuters, people that don't want to get out and go to a retail establishment or sit in a McDonald's drive-thru. So you have these drive-up shacks that, as you said, some are used for one-hour photo, etc. They're out, like, very small outbuildings with power and water. And instead of actually even having carts on wheels inside the building, they just build them into these little buildings. And now entire businesses have essentially, there are chains of these small building coffee shops now. Some of them are even full on construction builds with specific aesthetics and stuff, not just kind of like the ramshackle shack that somebody puts together with stuff. Like, they're designing their own chains around this. So it's this concept that has become a alternative, so you can get maybe a little bit cheaper espresso, and it's convenient because you just get off your main route, get some coffee at the drive-up, and get back on your way to work. So they've carved out a niche, and it's actually competitive. There's a lot of different ones now, and they're everywhere. And so what happened a step further is now the baristas wear less clothing, and have like costumes and theme days, and that is basically what Bikini Baristas are all about.
Let me see if I have this straight. These people are in a tiny little cubicle in a parking lot, and in addition to selling coffee, their draw is the fact that they're not wearing very much clothing, and yeah. People drive up to their window just for that purpose.
Yeah, that's basically it. It went from being a just a sort of quick alternative that wasn't a chain or wasn't a retail outlet you have to go into, and you might know the family or just a small group of people that are running it, to now chains of places that offer basically the coffee, the convenience, as well as like semi-nude or like partially clothed baristas.
Wow.
So while you're sitting there and she's, or not he as much.
Oh, is it called a barista if it's a male?
Baristrix. I don't know.
We need to learn some more about this.
I think barista is male and female.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah,
well, I learned something today.
Yeah. It's, I think, sort of a non-gender specific term.
Anyway, that's yet another thing we don't have on Long Island that, well, I don't know if we need the Bikini Barista so much, but we do need those little tiny houses, right? That would be kind of nice.
Yeah, it certainly is something that could emerge. But I think it competes with Starbucks as far as the sadness with which coffee has evolved in this weird, perverted, sort of mutated form. But it appeals to, I guess, guys in trucks or something. I don't know.
If they can pull the truck around to that little tiny house in the parking lot. But, well, that's one of many things that are different about the Seattle area. The only other thing I would point out, we only have a couple of minutes to do this, is the numbering scheme of streets. It drives me crazy because it's not only in Seattle that everything seems to be numbered instead of having names. And when you think about it, all the names of streets that we're familiar with seems to be mostly absent here, because outside of Seattle, the numbers continue. And into different cities. We drove to Rainier earlier in the show, and we were looking at little tiny roads. I went to farms, and it's something like 398th Avenue. And like, what kind of farmer tells people, yeah, I live on 398th Avenue, rather than, you know, Old Buckshot Lane, you know, something that was named by this great-grandpa or something years and years ago. I don't know. I'm trying to get used to that. I'm trying to figure it all out. And I can't really seem to find information about how this evolved or didn't evolve. But I guess that's something you're pretty much used to, right? All the houses you grew up with pretty much have numbered addresses.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's usually a street crossed with an avenue, and each address itself will have the cross street as well as, I guess, a house number. So if you live on 191st and you are, I guess, house 22, you might be 19122.
That makes sense. No,
on a certain avenue.
That's similar to the way it works in Queens, but that's Queens. Here it seems to be everywhere, and I don't know if it stretches beyond Tacoma and to the rest of the state, but I just found it amazing that there are so few streets that actually have names. Everyone has a triple-digit number as the street that's closest to their house, and it's suburbia too, so it's rather unusual.
We need to talk to some postmasters or letter carriers to get the scoop on why Washington is the way it is about this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much I want to learn and experiment with and explore some more, but we're out of time. Before we go, though, we would be remiss if we did not remind people that this is still the fundraising season at WUSB, and we would like people to call in, even though we're not here. We're out in the Pacific Northwest right now, but we would really like for people to call in and pledge during our show, or I guess during Finn's show.
Or online.
Yes, if you want to call now, please call now. 631-632-6901 is our phone number. And here's something cool that, well, it might be cool. I don't know. Tell me what you think of this, Kyle, because I just came up with the idea right now.
Okay.
If people call in the first half hour of the show following us and say that they're pledging for Off the Wall, and they pledge $20 or more, we will send you a postcard from the next cool place we visit. What do you think about that? We'll think of something to say in the postcard. We'll write your name and address, and you will get a postcard from Kyle and Emmanuel somewhere in the world. And all you have to do is pledge $20 to 631 632-6901. What do you think?
I like that.
WUSB is one of these stations. It's one of the unique gems of the FM dial. And we've heard a couple of cool stations out here, but I got to say, nothing matches the spirit of WUSB. Hearing them from all this distance is really heartening.
Yeah, and it's a really amazing transformational time at the station, and it's exciting and it's going to be interesting in the future, and we want to be a part of that. So keep listening and keep supporting community radio, as I know you all do.
Yes, 631-632-6901. I know there's room for some more calls there. We can't see them. This isn't even today that we're taping this. But we know that there are people out there listening right now that are thinking, hey, should I call and pledge $20 or more? I can use a credit card. After all, I won't even feel it. And then one day I will get, and one day within the next few months, we promise, you will get a postcard from us. And it won't be one of these mass-produced pieces of garbage. It'll be a full paragraph of something that we write with our own hands.
Yeah, it won't be a form postcard. But this is interesting because we could pick a place now specifically to mess with people, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you can't pick a place. You can't tell us where to go other than giving suggestions.
So we do.
But we might. Who knows where we'll wind up? We always go to weird places. Maybe Kyle could tell the folks where we've been in the past so they have an idea of what they could be in for.
Gosh, where have we been? Like, just on this trip or anytime?
No, anytime, because we take many trips,
sure.
Yes.
Tirana?
Tirana, Albania. How would you like a postcard from Albania?
Montenegro?
Montenegro, former Yugoslav Republic.
Skopje?
That's a city. That's in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia.
Or if you're cool, just Macedonia.
If you want to get into a fight with some Greeks, yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, we already talked about how that's not going to happen.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, the thing is, you'll get a postcard. It might be from Cleveland. Who knows?
Or Moose Breath, Ontario.
Moose Jaw. That's not Ontario.
Dog Breath.
Uh-huh.
Or I'm making these up.
All right, listen, we're out of time. Thanks to those people calling in, and please call in for the next half hour or so, 631-632-6901. Say you're pledging for Off the Wall, pledge $20 or more, get a postcard from us, and hey, maybe you can even talk the guy on after us into more stuff. Who knows?
Maybe.
I presume that guy is Finn. If so, hi, Finn. We'll see you in the future.
Finn's the guy.
Yeah.
The bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle, and the hills the greenest green in Seattle. Like a beautiful child growing up free and wild, full of hopes and full of fears, full of laughter, full of tears, full of dreams to last the years in Seattle. Seattle. When it's time to leave your home and your loved ones, it's the hardest thing a boy can ever do. And you pray that you will find someone warm and sweet and kind, but you're not sure what's waiting there for you. The bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle, and the hills of the greenest green in Seattle. Like a beautiful child growing up free and wild, full of hopes and full of fears, full of laughter, full of tears, full of dreams to last the years in Seattle. In Seattle. When you find your own true love, you will know it by her smile, by the look in her eye. Set of pine trees in the air, never knew a day so fair. It makes you feel so proud that you could cry. The bluest sky you ever seen are in Seattle, and the hills the greenest green in Seattle. Like a child growing up free and wild,
full of hopes and full of fears, full of laughter, full of tears.